contracts feature very prominently in this literature, and the idea is that first, best effort levels aren't usually achieved because of imperfect contracts, and the property rights model is used to try and understand then a firm's organization decision in this context. And so, as I mentioned, this is a rich theoretical literature, but the empirical evidence is relatively scant, and we try to make a contribution to the empirical side as well as on the theory side. But there are a couple of notable studies that use Chinese trade data to test the property rights model. And two of the notable ones is the one by Feenstra and Hansen, where they try to understand the organization decisions of foreign invested firms in China that do processing exports. Because processing export regime in China can be broken down by who owns the plant and who owns the inputs that are actually processed in these plants. And what they find is that much of the decision can be explained by key variation in industry characteristics. And further, a recent study by Fernandez and Tang introduced within industry heterogeneity among firms to understand those firms that vertically integrate and those that outsource. So what we want to do is essentially look beyond processing trade. And the idea is, one thing we note in the data is that on average, foreign invested enterprises or FIEs in China actually export less than half of their output. The rest are sold domestically. And also, much of the export processing regime decisions in China can be explained by variations in industry and province characteristics. So what we want to understand is, when we look at the aggregate FDI inflow data in China or foreign direct investment inflow data, we find that in the 1990s, Sino-foreign joint ventures or joint ventures were the primary form of FDI coming into China. But by the late 1990s, closer to 2000, we see there's a dramatic takeoff of wholly foreign-owned enterprises or WFOEs. So let me show you a graph of contracted FDI inflows in China by the different types of FDI coming in for the period 92 to 99. To make a quick comment, contracted FDI is probably not the best measure because this basically just represents the monies that are promised to a project, not necessarily those that are invested, but we don't have information by type in this period for utilized FDI, but I'll show it for the late 1990s. So what we want out of this graph is to look at the trends, even though we are using contracted FDI. So the first line to focus on is the total FDIs. We see that there is a big spike in FDIs coming into China after 1992, which coincides with the period of Deng Xiaoping's famous Southern Tour, when he encouraged foreign investors to come into China. And we see that during the rest of the period, there's a relative decline in FDI. But the important and interesting thing to us was that the form of FDI coming into China during this period predominantly was of the joint venture type, while the wholly foreign-owned enterprises didn't seem to exceed that type up until the late 1990s. Yeah?
Wasn't there a law that foreigners could not come in and have these wholly owned?
No, actually, there was a law passed in 1986, the law on wholly foreign-owned enterprises, that actually allowed them to come and establish wholly owned subsidiaries outside of special economic zones and other sort of special areas, which is the surprising thing as to then why were they not more popular, and hopefully I'll be able to talk about it a little more. So looking at this trend, the important thing to take away from the graph is that the Sino-foreign joint ventures were the predominant form of FDI in the early 1990s. Looking at 1997 post, for which we do have utilized FDI data by the different types, the first thing to note is that the FDI inflows were increasing during this period in total. But the really interesting thing is that we see that after 1999, the wholly owned foreign owned type of investment just takes off. They account for more than half of the total FDI inflows, while the joint venture type of investments sort of stable out during this period. And this is very interesting to us. What's going on? One of the first things that comes to our mind is a lot of legal policy changes taking place in the backdrop of China joining the WTO. So that's sort of the setting for our study. And we want to understand what explains the different types of investment coming into China. So ideally, what we would like to do is look at all the choice set that the foreign firm faces when deciding to enter China. Unfortunately, we don't have that. So what we have instead We have all the information on joint ventures that were established in the early 1990s, and we can see if they decide to transition out of that form to becoming wholly domestic or wholly foreign-owned or remain a joint venture post-2000. And so what we want to look at are the firm-level determinants that explain this organization choice. And we use Chinese data, and we think China provides a good setting to study this because there were dramatic liberalizations of domestic institutions that took place in anticipation of China joining WTO, which we think impacted the incentives for foreign firms to change their organizational form. And we use firm-level data, not trade data, to analyze this. And again, we try to understand firm-level, not industry or province-level determinants of what drives this decision choice. So for the rest of the talk, I'll try to provide a brief contextual background that sort of sets up where we're coming from, why our model and empirics make sense. And then I'll try to talk through the main ingredients for theoretical model that generates our hypothesis, which we'll take to the data, and then discuss the econometric model, our results, and finally conclude. So like Wenji just mentioned, why, if wholly owned foreign owned enterprises were allowed since 1986, which they were, why wasn't it more popular given that it comes with control advantage? And our understanding is that this was not as popular because there were several restrictions that were placed on wholly owned enterprises, foreign enterprises. One of them being they were excluded from key sectors of the economy, such as banking, services, telecommunications, and even in manufacturing, they were barred from entering strategic sectors like nuclear power plants, satellite, even soft drinks. And on top of that, their foreign firms were required to export 100% of their output, and they were not allowed to establish after-sales services within China. So what that meant is they were essentially barred from the domestic market. However, these restrictions did not apply to Singaporean joint ventures or joint ventures. And so from the foreign firm's perspective, it made sense to partner up with a Chinese firm because it would give them access to the domestic market and the supply channels, as well as give them an ally and partner with inside knowledge of the political networks, because oftentimes this approval for foreign projects not only came from the federal government, but varied by the different provincial government levels and industries. And from the domestic partner's point of view, so the Chinese firm's point of view, partnering up with a foreign firm would give them access to presumably more advanced technology, as well as export marketing expertise, and very importantly in the 1990s, access to capital, because it's been well documented that indigenous firms, Chinese firms in this period, were very much credit constrained. So what happened then in the late 1990s was these dramatic changes in terms of legal changes as well as policy stances towards foreign and domestic firms. Notably, the domestic changes in leadership led to greater access and capital for indigenous private firms. And on top of that, it became more attractive for foreign firms to form wholly owned entities because there was constitutional recognition of the non-state sector, contract law improved enforcement of intellectual property rights, which is a concern for foreign firms coming in with advanced technology. And on top of that, China made several WTO commitments, which are as follows. The important ones I'll be highlighting are basically China promised to remove any discriminatory practices against imported inputs and foreign firms. They also promised to remove export subsidies that were not compliant with WTO rules. And importantly, under trade-related investment measures, any type of, so foreign investment project approvals were not to be hinged on things like requirement of technology transfer or local content requirements. So these prohibitions were removed. And lastly, under the trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, China in general promised to uphold protection of property rights within its boundaries. So in the backdrop of this massive type of policy changes taking place, we think it makes sense to try and understand what drove the decision choices of joint ventures to transition into different organizational forms. And we think the property rights model provides a good framework to understand it because imperfect contracts were endemic in this period, and that features prominently in these types of models. So the idea is essentially, if there are imperfect contracts, and you cannot write a contract to fully compensate managers or partners' effort within a joint venture. They won't exert full effort, or what we call first best effort. And there is sort of a tension. So how do you, how do the partners come up with an arrangement where they do exert the best amount of effort possible? And what they, and what we do is, in using the property rights model, which is adapted from Feenstra and Hansen's, we think that a partnership is more productive, obviously, the more effort you exert, but it depends on who owns the firm. Ownership is key in driving your optimal effort levels. And since there are imperfect contracts, what happens is that after the production process is over, the parties are actually going to Nash bargain over the project surplus. Essentially, they're going to get together, and depending on who has how much bargaining power, the profits are going to be split. So hopefully, I'll be able to give you a more concrete idea as I talk through our model, what goes on and what are the assumptions we make. So what we're trying to answer is essentially what drives organization choice, so we can understand these decisions for joint ventures transitioning into either a wholly owned foreign enterprise, wholly domestic owned, or remaining a Singaporean joint venture. And the way we set up our model is essentially we assume that these two partners, foreign and Chinese partner, come together in China to produce one unit of good using essentially advanced technology that the foreign partner brings, and then local production labor, as well as marketing expertise of the Chinese partner. And together, using these inputs, they produce this good. And so the managers, which can be either partner, will be exerting three types of efforts. So that's how we think about the tasks that need to be performed within the firm. And we assign the foreign partner exerting technology effort, because presumably they're the ones bringing in the advanced technology. While the domestic partner always exerts marketing effort because of their local connections and local knowledge. And we allow either partner to control production. So they can be in, so the foreign or the Chinese partner could be the one managing local production labor to adapt this technology to local production processes. And so the way efforts, revenues, and costs are related as follows. The more technology and production effort there is that the managers put into the firm, the more the revenues will be. Meanwhile, while increases in production effort and marketing effort will reduce costs. And time permitting, I will show you the our simple functional forms that we use, so this might become clearer, but this is the relationship we postulate for the moment. So what we want to do now is understand what will determine the level of effort, because as I mentioned before, if they're imperfect contracts, if parties cannot be fully compensated for their effort, they won't be putting in the optimal amount. So what is it that they actually put into the firm in this joint venture? And this will depend on the share of surplus that each party will receive once the production process takes place. So the profits will have to be divided in some manner. And obviously, the idea is the more, the larger the share you get of the profits, the more willing you are to exert effort into the firm, the basic intuition. And so how are the profits going to be divided? Like I mentioned before, it depends on the bargaining power of each party. So this is what this Nash bargaining solution means. Each party has some bargaining power. We call it, let's say, theta. And depending on that, you get that amount of the total surplus generated from the project. But it also depends on how much each partner will receive if this relationship doesn't work out. This is what's known as the outside options of the partners in the property rights theory. So the idea is, if your effort is very specific to that relationship or that joint venture, there's really not a lot of market value for it outside of the relationship. So the more relationship specific that effort, the harder it will be for you to be compensated. So each party will only earn a fraction of his or her marginal product outside of the relationship. So this comes straight out of the idea that if the relationship breaks down, you have to go out into the market. So for example, let's suppose the relationship breaks down and the Chinese partner leaves the firm. So now the foreign partner has to go out and find someone from the local market that can do the marketing. And the idea is if the Chinese partner has to leave, they had already put in effort into this firm. They will actually not be fully compensated because some of that effort that they put in is specific to that venture and it doesn't have any market value. So we assume that a fraction, and we call it psi in the paper, is what they actually get. And we allow this fraction to vary by the different tasks. So the amount that you get less for technology versus production versus marketing can differ. And so to put a little more structure on the outside options, because this will determine how much effort investment each party makes, we assume that if the foreign firm has control over production, the Chinese party's marketing investment effort will not be valued. So they will only put in marketing effort if they also control production. And therefore, this will have an influence in terms of how much the Chinese partner is willing to invest into the marketing process or tasks of the firm. And we further assume that if the Chinese partner has production control, the foreign partner will always receive less than their marginal product from technology efforts. So the idea is that essentially, if the Chinese partner controls production, there might be fear that their technology is leaking out of the firm. And we think it's reasonable to make these assumptions because even in anecdotal or case studies from the business literature, we find these fears are what foreign firms indeed face in interviews and surveys and such. So essentially, the tension that is brought into our model is that the technology effort by the foreign partner is highest when they control production, but so is marketing effort when the Chinese partner controls production. So there's going to be some trade-off when we actually solve for these effort levels. So our main end goal is essentially figuring out what are the optimal effort levels under these different organizational forms, because only then can we figure out the project surplus that will be generated. Because end of the day, what we're going to do is compare project surplus generated from these different organizational forms so we can make these comparisons and get a sense of what's the likelihood of transitioning into each of these different states. So I think I will have time to talk about our specific functional forms. And this is not to make things complicated, but I think it might be easier to see how these relationships are. So essentially, this is our profit function, where this is the revenue function. These are the cost of production. This is the cost of marketing. And we see that each of these efforts impacts the revenues and the costs. And obviously, revenue less all the costs are going to give us the profits for the firm. So it's a very simple linear form. And again, we adapted from Feenstra and Hansen. And what we also introduced is this notion of joint production. So the idea is just to highlight that this production effort will enhance both revenues, but it will also reduce costs. And so this just highlights the fact that it's going to be hard to compensate the production manager, say, by just paying him wages, because it's going to be hard to figure out what it is that he should be paid in terms of his marginal product. So this is just the simple form of our profits. And in terms of the cost of effort investments, we make, so essentially how much effort each party will put into the firm will also depend on these effort levels. And because the production effort depends on who controls production, this delta C parameter just stands for who owns it. If this is zero, the foreign party controls it. If it is one, the Chinese party controls it. And yeah.
In the previous slide, is there a reason why you choose to put the joint production effort in terms of cost of production or effort two rather than effort three? Because effort three is a marketing effort. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It makes seems to make sense that marketing effort has an impact on
revenue as well as cost. And that's a good point. And in fact, if we redid the analysis by including E3 in both our revenue and cost, it doesn't change our main predictions. We just wanted to keep it as simple in terms of the algebra. So we abstracted away from it. And we thought that thinking of the joint notion in the production effort made more sense because of the tension we were sort of introducing into our model.
But the assumption is that E3 is always by the Chinese partner, right?
Yes, E3 is always by the Chinese partner, and E1 is always by the foreign partner. So then, once we know what our profits are and what the cost of making these effort investments are, we will be able to compute the total surplus generated by the firm or the project. And it's essentially the profits less these costs of making effort investments. So as I mentioned before, if there were perfect contracts, the firm would essentially be maximizing this joint surplus. So we know there aren't, but I'd still like to point out what those optimal effort levels would be, because when I talk about the different solutions for the effort levels, I'd like to talk about it in terms of the first best, so we know how much essentially these organizational forms are deviating away from this first best. And if we worked out the algebra, basically if firms were maximizing this total surplus, they would be assigning technology effort to the foreign partner while the Chinese partner would be undertaking both production and marketing. So like I mentioned before, we have to make some assumptions about these outside options to actually pin down our effort level. So I'm just basically reiterating here in this slide. Essentially, if bargaining breaks down, the party that has ownership gets the can claim the residual profits from the farms. And then the bargaining weights that we assign to each partner is just a fixed weight theta and 1 minus theta. This can potentially vary, but we just abstract away from that complication and use fixed weights. And like I mentioned before, in terms of the outside options, each party only will get a fraction, and we call the psi of their marginal products. All of this notation I'm introducing because I want to talk about our effort level. So before I get there, at the end of this, what each party is doing is it's maximizing the project surplus, like I mentioned before, which is the total profits less the spread point payoffs, and then less these cost of equity investments. So spread point payoffs are essentially what it is if each firm, if the relationship were to break down, each party goes out into the market, what would they receive? That's what these spread point payoffs are. And they get a share depending on their bargaining weight. So essentially, the foreign partner will solve for technology effort because we presume they put that, they are the only ones who put that effort in. The Chinese partner always solves for the marketing effort, and either partner could solve for E2, but it'll depend on who owns the firm and who owns the production process. And so that's what I'm going to show you right here. So this is not meant to be a daunting slide by any means, but I wanted to show this because once we know what the effort levels are, we can actually plug these back in into a profit function. That's how we figure out what the total surplus is for the firm. And that really guides our empirical work. So what I want to just point out quickly before talking about each of these boxes is that this theta, like I mentioned before, is this bargaining weight. So essentially, theta is the bargaining weight the foreign partner has. 1 minus theta is what the Chinese partner has. These size are essentially the proportionate loss in the return from investing in either marketing, technology, or production effort. And we call this psi IPR, intellectual property rights, because the idea is for the technology effort that it's the proportionate loss from your technology leaking out, and hence these notations. And C, psi C is the proportionate loss in putting in production effort if the relationship were to break down, and psi M, the proportionate loss if the for the marketing effort if the relationship were to break down. So one thing, and these gammas, we introduced this into our cost making the effort investments. What's important to note about this is we note that the disutility that a foreign partner gets from investing effort is higher than what the Chinese partner would get. And the reason we make this assumption is because they have to manage, presumably the foreign firm is managing several international activities. And what this does for us, without going into too much detail, is essentially we eliminate this organization form where the Chinese firm owns the firm and the foreign partner controls production. So what we presume is that a foreign firm will never be willing to just control production. They'll also want to own the firm. And mathematically, we work it out where this type of organization form is always dominated by the other ones. So now, just looking at these other boxes, the way to read this table would be essentially the columns are showing who owns the enterprise, and the rows are showing who controls the production process. And so this bottom left corner is showing when the Chinese firm owns the firm and controls the production process. So essentially, this is the wholly domestic owned firm. And what we see is that the first best in terms of marketing effort is achieved. So remember, I had mentioned that the Chinese partner is the only one putting in the marketing effort, and they will put in their best efforts when they also own the firm. Obviously, that is not the case with technology effort because the foreign firm is putting it in, and they actually have to bargain for project surplus. The production effort is also not at first best when the Chinese firm controls production, because we introduce this idea that if the Chinese firm is controlling production, there's possibility that the technology might still leak out. So that's how we think about the production effort. And then looking at the top right box, essentially this is when a firm is wholly foreign owned. The foreign partner both owns the firm and controls the production process. And we see again is that when there's ownership is assigned to the party, the effort that they're putting in is at the first best. And again, for E3, the marketing effort, it's not going to be first best because the Chinese partner has to bargain over the surplus. And the production effort is actually going to be the first best, but for the foreign firm, not the Chinese firm. And finally, this box shows us what we think of as the Sino-foreign joint venture. So this is when the foreign firm owns the firm and the Chinese firm controls production. And we see that none of these efforts are going to be at their first best levels. Yeah.
Can I backtrack a little?
Yes.
You're assuming that there's this inherent risk of these Chinese firms leaking technology.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of going through this, and I'm just throwing this out, could you introduce like a search cost, or in terms of the quality of the Chinese partner? I mean, how do they get together? Right?
So we actually don't model that. So we start in, like, let's say time zero, these two partners just come together.
Okay.
So we don't model how each partner finds each other.
I see.
So we don't introduce the notion of search costs or some sort of search going on before this partnership is formed.
Right. So it's inherent in every Chinese firm that they might make.
Yes. Okay. So you might think it's an extreme assumption we make, but again, we think it is consistent with at least the anecdotal evidence that we have read about. But, you know, I'm happy to hear.
But that's anecdotal, right?
Sure.
I think with the search question, what's nice is you can put in probabilities, risks,
right,
of how they behave.
Sure.
Another alternative I can see is doing sequentially, in terms of pairing them up, that these foreign firms will learn gradually over time. And I think that's anecdotally also documented. A lot of foreign firms going step by step by step.
Right.
Not just, you know, going.
Sure.
By their own firm, but maybe they started out, as you said before, with a joint venture, and then they chose to go on their own.
Sure.
So sort of this learning process.
Right.
To find this partner.
So that would really explain the joint venture formation. But I mean, that's...
Or the choosing from going to joint venture to a wholly owned.
Okay.
Right?
That's a good point.
That's right. So this is what we talked about earlier. So what is the choice behind that decision?
Right.
It's because you've either been there before and have had other alliance partners or joint venture partners or some other experience that doesn't figure in this model.
No, I absolutely agree. And Anu's suggestion was to think about even controlling for the age of the firm to try and get to it in a rough manner. But that's a good point.
But I mean, in terms of model, search cost.
Would be, that is something to think about. Thanks, Wendy. You had a question?
Yeah, I mean, so I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the limitations of the model. I mean, we talked a little bit about, we're assuming that the technology same.
Right.
All foreign firms are bringing in the same technology, and that's a pretty strong assumption.
Yes.
Firms can bring in, you know, old technology or technology that's already spilled out. I mean, I actually don't have a problem assuming that a Chinese firm might be risking technology, because I actually think you're risking technology no matter who the firm is. So whether it's a Chinese firm or a European firm or a Canadian firm or whatever, I mean, the literature sort of establishes that when you have a joint venture partner, you need to be worried about risking some of the spill of technology. But I mean, there's also market access issues in terms of the experience that you might be gaining through the partner that's not part of this model.
No, and I think one of the limitations, and this is something we're thinking really hard about, is it really right that this is how a Sino-foreign joint venture, the way we think about it, where the Chinese firm has the production control and the foreign firm owns the firm, if this really represents a joint venture? And this is something we talked about with Anu, where essentially if we proxied with, let's say, equity shares, that might give us a sense of who owns and controls the firm. But in practice, equity shares actually do not reflect this control and ownership aspect. So this is something, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a limitation of the model, but this is something we're struggling with to decide if this really is the right view of a joint venture. So in addition, when we spoke, the idea about, you know, powerful affiliations, how that might figure into our model, that's a very good point, because the idea is, because as I'll show you later in the data, actually majority of our firms remain joint ventures in the post-2000 period, and it might be because they just want the local knowledge that the Chinese partner brings. So I think that's something we definitely have to think about, either including or extending our model to incorporate it. So going back to this slide, essentially the point of showing this is to A, show you what these effort solutions are, because this will go directly into us being able to figure out the total profits that the firm generates in under these different organizational forms, and hence we'll be able to compare them. So what we do is essentially we figure out the project surplus that One, that would be generated if the firm was wholly foreign-owned, again, using those effort levels that we have identified from our model, versus that from a Sino-foreign joint venture, and similarly, the wholly domestic-owned, minus what would have been the project surplus from a Sino-foreign joint venture. And writing it simply in terms of the income generated from the technology effort, production and marketing effort, we can do the comparisons as to what explains the likelihood of the firm transitioning into these different states. So remember, our goal was to understand the firm level determinants that explains this organizational choice process. And so the firm level determinants we have identified are essentially value added from the technology effort, value added from the production and the marketing effort. And what we find is that higher the technology value added from the technology effort, the more likely the joint venture will transition to a wholly owned foreign firm relative to remaining as a joint venture. However, they're going to be less likely to become wholly domestic owned relative to being a Sino-foreign joint venture. The higher the value added from marketing effort, we find that the less likely the joint ventures will become wholly foreign owned, but more likely that they would become wholly domestic owned relative, again, to remaining as a Sino-foreign joint venture. In terms of value added from the production effort, we find that if, from our model, the higher the value added, the more likely they could transition into either of these states, again, relative to remaining as a Sino-foreign joint venture. Yeah?
In the data, do you see a lot of switching between being domestic?
Oh, you mean if you were domestic owned in the beginning and then you become a joint venture?
I mean, I'm assuming you have more than one project, right?
So what I observe, the data that I observe are firm level data. So it's, and then I have these identifiers that come with each of these firms, and essentially I track the same identifiers over time. And if one was established as a joint, so we look at the joint ventures from a certain period, and then we see if they changed their ownership status over time. And that's how we identify the switches. So I don't know.
So you're only looking at the joint ventures and then
Right. But there are switches from being domestic owned to joint ventures. We don't include them in our analysis.
Okay.
Yeah. In the larger data, we do observe that. Yeah.
And is there any way you can match up these joint ventures by foreign parent?
No. Unless I look at it by name. So one if I'm thinking of a well-known MNC, maybe I could, but if it's less well known, because the interesting thing with the Chinese names are often they'll have the name of the parent, but it might be something like Happy Feet, or maybe I'm translating it incorrectly, but it might not be very indicative of the actual parent's name. So it's much harder to do, unless like I was talking to you about linking it with the, let's say, U.S. subsidiaries to the U.S. parents.
So I'm looking at this, and I'm wondering how this plays in with the environment that you described earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand that there's greater technological input by the foreign firm, then they want more control over this.
Right.
But wouldn't they want that when property rights were especially bad?
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't they have wanted this more in mm-hmm. in the pre WTO period, assuming that the WTO gives you what
mm-hmm.
you might expect? So I would actually expect to see the opposite, which is as the environment gets better,
mm-hmm.
I would expect to see less of this,
mm-hmm.
not more.
You mean less of transitioning
into wholly owned.
So the way we think about the predominance of these joint ventures were because of particular restrictions, including poor property rights. But it might be the case, and this is something we won't be able to tell, is that let's say even if they came in with a lower level of technology, over time, as the environment improves and they want to bring in, let's say, better technology, they want to then have full control over the firm. And so therefore, we would see these transitions. But the predominance of the joint ventures were primarily, we think, led by the particular restrictions that were imposed on them that were imposed on wholly foreign-owned enterprises, but not on the joint ventures. So, I mean, you're right. They would always want to protect their property, but they also want a foothold in China. So the best way to get in was to form joint ventures, and then over time, the changing environment allowed them to think of other organizational choices. So that's how we think about it.
So, but then that's not really a property rights explanation, right? And that's the question. Then isn't what you're observing the fact that the regulation changed? Let them come in, and so they now go in for the wholly owned. It's not about,
or is it about
incomplete
specific
contracts
or
no? It's about constraint optimization, right? And if some of the constraints are removed,
sure. And I mean,
yeah,
it's
but the constraints are not the incomplete contract that is there. It's not about the property rights. It's just that those sectors were excluded, and you couldn't do that. That's why you went
so
in
you
with
went
a joint venture earlier, and now you're stepping up control. So it's not the explanation that I think you're offering. It's the liberalization.
So I mean, there's certainly regulations as well as changes in the property rights regime, which we think in tandem explain the behavior of this firm. So it might be the case the joint ventures were formed because of these restrictions that were imposed on the wholly owned enterprises, but as the regime changed, the behavior that we observed are consistent with better protection of property rights. However, like my conversation with Heather, it's possible there are alternative explanations as well. And we interpret it in the light of our model as well as the contextual background at the time for China, but we do acknowledge that there might be alternative explanations as well for why they switch. Yeah.
Do you have firm location?
I do.
So why don't you explore that? Because there's a lot of property rights where we province to province.
So we
use that.
We do control for province level characteristics. Sure, and actually that's a very good point. Vidya also suggested looking at some measure of property rights and see how that changes over time to make a convincing argument that it did. And in fact, the measure that we do have, and I apologize, I don't present it here, we do see variation by province. Particularly, coastal provinces in China are known to have better property rights, so that is something we can consider.
Work has shown that influences the forms of the joint.
Right. Right, and in fact, that is something Feenstra and Hansen do when they look at the different organizational forms within export processing, because some provinces just have better, I guess, outside options for the partners.
I have another clarification question.
Yeah.
So when you said earlier on that wholly owned enterprises were allowed from 1986, and they were just excluded in certain sectors like France, so does that mean these firms really had the option to do this and they didn't choose it? Or that there was some other type of restrictions that prevented them from doing that?
So they were legally allowed, except for those particular sectors. And in fact, we only look at the manufacturing sector where they were always allowed, so we don't get into issues of, you know, they're now all of a sudden we're seeing them because it's these new sectors. So they were legally allowed to establish 100% foreign-owned subsidiaries. And not just within particular zones, like these special economic zones or development areas. They could have chosen if they wanted to. But again, we argue that the reason they probably didn't, and we think the primary reason is because they didn't have access to domestic distribution channels or essentially the domestic market. And that's what they wanted to tap into.
But I thought there were a lot of restrictions. Like,
yeah.
Regulatory tax issues and the environment was such that even if they're legally allowed, that didn't really mean that foreign firms could do that.
Sure, so there were a lot more, it was more burdensome to form that wholly owned subsidiary even though it was legally allowed. And so to us it was interesting because the laws existed, but we were still not seeing these wholly owned forms. And so there was even in terms of getting approval, and navigating through these, getting the approval process going was difficult for just establishing the wholly owned subsidiaries. So I agree, there were these other impediments in place, but again, they were legally allowed according to the law books.
And did the WTO then change any of those?
Yeah, so there were, essentially, I don't know if this particular law was overturned, but the commitment that they made was not to discriminate against foreign firms no matter what the sectors they're entering into and in terms of the process to set up a firm, the bureaucracy involved in it.
So why don't you look at actual property rights laws rather than that, which seems very interesting. Like there was a big law in 95, so why wouldn't you use that?
That's a good point. Our data spans from 98 to 2006, so in terms of looking at big shocks in law changes, we don't observe a lot during this time period. So it would be nice if we had particular law, especially by sector and by geographic location, but we, at least to our knowledge, have not been able to identify it. So, I mean, if you do know about it, I'd certainly be happy to incorporate that. Yeah?
I had a question about the MSUs. Mm-hmm. Is there any classification of the what's so called a technology contribution by the foreign party? Is it because in terms of property rights, mm-hmm. it could be a patent that's closely related to production, mm-hmm. and it could be trademark, which is closely related to marketing. So have you considered these differences of mm-hmm. the different technologies?
Very good question, and unfortunately the data that we have, it doesn't break out any sort of what we would think of as proxying for technology, other than, so what we try to get at is by looking at indirect measures like total factor productivity, which presumably reflects if it's more technologically advanced, it should have higher productivity, but we don't have information about either licensing agreements or patents or trademarks in the data. Yeah.
Does you, first of all, sorry I came late, I didn't hear your data set. Mm-hmm. Does your data distinguish the firms, their wholly private firm, mm-hmm. or state-owned?
Oh, yes.
Enterprises, or
yeah.
there are some collective?
Yep, and in fact, you know, I'll start talking about the data. Okay. I can distinguish between state-owned, private-owned, foreign-owned, and then the various types of foreign-owned, which we actually don't utilize in this study.
Now, if you have that, now my mm-hmm. question, if you have state-owned and collective, not
private-owned,
mm-hmm. a lot of buying out, those decisions mm-hmm. are made in higher level,
right.
not in the firm's level.
Right.
So how do you model that?
So we don't actually model it, but we try to control for it, and I'll show it in our results, where we try to control for the level of affiliation of the firm. So if the firm is affiliated with the central or the provincial government, so presumably they have a strong state partner, how that influences essentially these value added from these different types of effort, actually primarily the technology effort. So we try to utilize that information, because if we try to split up the number of switchers that we observe by state-owned, collective-owned, and private, it's just a very small number to do any meaningful analysis on. But we try to control for the level of affiliation of the domestic partner. So let me then talk about the data. So the large data set, essentially these are the annual surveys of industrial production that are collected by China's National Bureau of Statistics. And these include all state-owned firms operating in China and all non-state-owned firms that have sales above 5 million yuan or about $600,000. And we identify ownership using registration status that is assigned at the time that the firm is established by the National Bureau of Statistics. So we abstract away from using equity shares, because what has been documented is that equity shares do not necessarily represent the control and the ownership rights that a firm enjoys. So by law, the share should represent it, but they don't, because oftentimes what has been found is that it's the contract that's written between these two parties that actually determines control rights and ownership rights. So we use this registration status, which essentially these are particular codes that are assigned to the firm, to see who went from being a joint venture to other types. And what we do is further subset the data and constrain it to only be manufacturing firms, because again, we wanted to look at a sector where foreign firms were always allowed. and then we restrict the analysis to joint ventures that were established in the 1990s. Again, that period where we saw this big influx of joint ventures, so from 1992 to 2000. And then we, again, just look at the joint ventures that actually transitioned anywhere between 2001 and 2006. And I'll show you what that percentage is. So from our total data set, which is a little over 12,000 firms, we find that about 14% become wholly foreign owned, about 7% wholly domestic owned, and about 79% remain joint venture. Yep.
Why do you include state-owned firms?
Why do we include state-owned firms? So
I don't see anything to do with property rights protection.
So we don't. So one thing, we don't distinguish the domestic partner by state-owned or private-owned. We can, but one argument we make later, and I'll try to explain as we go through the empirical results is that having a powerful state partner might help better protect foreign firms' technology, in the sense they are often known to block competition within the same industry, and so that might just prohibit other firms from starting a new firm, or maybe an employee from the existing joint venture going out and opening up a new firm that would potentially be a vehicle for transferring that technology. So we think that a state partner can prohibit competition and or even give them access to, give them better access to markets in China. But we don't actually distinguish when we look at the Chinese partner if they're state owned or private owned, except to utilize that affiliation variable.
So are any of these JVs dissolved?
Are any of the,
I mean, you know, because you said so many convert.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And some
so
continue.
So of the group that we identified established between 92 and 2000, and then, so they do dissolve. I don't have the exact percentage. Essentially what we first do is create a panel of firms that exist or that were established between 92-2000 and exist up until 06, because we want to see who transition. But of total joint ventures, certainly there's firms do get, they leave the sample. So it might be that it's a true exit, or it might be that they fell below that sales threshold. So we won't know for sure, but I'm sure there's dissolution of firms that goes
and
on.
So then don't you think that this brings us back to that firm level issue? Because maybe the dissolution is part of the wholly owned strategy. I just get out of the venture, but I go in by myself, and it's not reflected in that transition because it's happening at the firm level.
If your survivorship bias here, because you're only keeping the ones
that are surviving. And that's absolutely right. So in a sense, we try to control for it by including measures of productivity, but it is possible that it is the case that we are capturing firms that have survived up until that period.
But so basically 20% of these are no longer in a JV status.
Right.
So of the ones that exist over your whole time period, 20% of them are either bought out by the domestic partner
or the foreign
partner. Bought out by the foreign partner.
Right.
Because
the joint venture doesn't exist anymore. Sorry. Go ahead.
How many percentage of foreign bought in?
So 14% are bought out by the foreign partner and 7% by the domestic partner.
Okay. Does your data show after 2000 there's more buyout by
So these are all transitions that take place between 2001 and 2006. So this is the post 2000 period.
Okay, so we don't. Do you look at year by year?
So we do look at by year, and I haven't presented it here, but 50% of the transitions take place before 2004 and 50% afterwards. So there's no one particular year where we see a huge spike. Although in 2000, it's about 30% of the transitions take place, but it's sort of evenly spaced out in this time period.
So that's why I'm arguing there's a lot of reason is behind that is the policy and the Chinese domestic political system. And if you notice that after 2002, probably 2000, it's different administration which they influence policy, which a lot of the US or international observers have. The Chinese do have retraction from WTA, from market reform, which is before the Jiang and the Zhu administration. They are fully implemented. Trying to push that, but under who and when administration, they have sought out to track back, which is by far older observers international. They recognize that. So under that background, your data might just show part of that.
Sure, but since the transitions are spaced out almost evenly during this period, we are not able to see like a systematic pattern of maybe the new administration's policy overturning what we believe were the incentives these firms might have faced given that they joined the WTO and so and other policy and legal changes that were taking place. But that's certainly a good point to keep in mind.
The other way you can look at, maybe you can look at by sectors, because normally technology, high tech sectors or energy sectors, those are controlled mostly, you know, state-owned or some government control.
Right.
But if you look at those low-tech, like the shoes, the textiles, those
right.
kind of, maybe you can look at just suggestions.
No, that's a good point. And we do try to control for industry and at the two-digit industry level in our empirical analysis. Yeah.
Are the transitions broken or evenly spaced over years and evenly spaced over whether or not they became fully foreign or fully domestic under the seat?
So I actually haven't, I don't know, I don't remember top of my head by transition and by year, but overall, by year, we see almost 30% of the transitions taking place in 2001, and then about 20% in 02, 03, and then after 04, the rest of the 50% of the transitions. But by type within those years, I can remember.
Okay, so you don't know if perhaps all of the domestic for, ones were front-loaded?
No, I actually, but that's a good point. That's something I can easily look at, and I don't recall top of my head what that number is. You had another question?
Yeah. Did you look at if there were any transitions before 2000?
We haven't. So what did you have in mind?
So I'm thinking the expectation effect, right? So it's not that you actually changed anything,
mm-hmm.
and in fact, you know, the WTO was the paper that they signed and didn't really change anything.
Mm-hmm.
Anything de facto.
So, right.
But firms might be expecting that this change is actually going to translate into something.
Mm-hmm.
That's beneficial for them,
mm-hmm.
and they might be reacting to that expectation of okay, this is coming, so mm-hmm. I'm going to change, and this might happen earlier on.
Sure, and we can try to do it again because we have data from 98. It'll be a very short time horizon when we can look to see if firms as of 98 if they are switching in 99. But that's something we can try to do.
And I think it'd be interesting to know uh-huh. if your percentage of domestic box joint ventures
mm-hmm.
varied across your whole time period. Because I still wonder if these domestic box ones mm-hmm. are because the Western firms have just decided to divest from China. They
right, right,
well.
Right.
You know, I'm curious how that changes over your time period.
Sure. Yeah, that's something I can look at. And I think that ties into Tony's question about breaking it up by year. But yeah, for the transitions before 2000, because it's only 2 years, I'm not sure what we may expect, but something we can certainly try to see if that expectation type of explanation is taking place. Okay. So the econometric model we use is a multinomial logic model. So essentially, we're trying to predict the likelihood that the joint venture becomes wholly domestic-owned, wholly foreign-owned, or remain a joint venture. And so we are using the model, the firm-level characteristics that we observe as of 2000 are sort of our explanatory variables, and we try to understand, given those characteristics, the firms, are they switching into these three possible organizational forms of joint ventures, WFOEs, and wholly domestic-owned enterprises. So essentially, we are going to be using characteristics as of 2000 and before any of these transitions take place. So the key variables that we have in our that come from our model is the first one is we proxy for the value added from technology effort by distance to the domestic technology frontier. So what I mean by that is essentially we capture the difference in log of total factor productivity of the most productive domestic firm in a joint venture's own four-digit industry. And the presumption here is that the more technologically advanced the firm, the more likely the foreign partner to exert higher technology effort. And so we use this as a proxy for value added from that type of effort. The value added from production effort is proxied by the log of value added that the firm generates. And it's essentially the real value added in 1,000 yuan. And we also control for the size of the firm by the total number of employees in that joint venture. And finally, our third measure, which is the value added from marketing effort, is proxied for by the domestic sales share of the firm. So what is the share of total sales that are actually sold in the domestic market? And so the first set of results that I'll be showing you only includes these variables that come from our model. We are not controlling for industry or province characteristics here. And the way to read this table is in the first column, this looks at the likelihood of switching to a wholly foreign-owned enterprise depending on these characteristics. In the second column, the likelihood of switching to a wholly domestic-owned enterprise. And so to interpret these coefficients, what this is telling us is essentially the greater the value added from technology effort, the more likely the joint venture is to switch to a wholly foreign-owned enterprise relative to remaining as a Sino-foreign joint venture. So all of these results are relative to remaining as a Sino-foreign joint venture, because that's our reference group. And what we see is that, consistent with the predictions from our model, the greater the value added from technology effort, or essentially the more technologically advanced the firm is, the greater the likelihood that they will become wholly foreign-owned, and less the likelihood that they will become wholly domestic-owned. Moving down the rows, we see that increases in the value added from production effort increases the likelihood that the firm will become wholly foreign-owned relative to remaining Sino-foreign joint venture, but we don't see an effect in terms of predicting the likelihood of becoming wholly domestic-owned. And in fact, this coefficient is negative, which is at odds with what we would expect from our current model. And then controlling for size, what we find is that size is not a significant predictor in terms of the transition to a wholly foreign-owned enterprise, but it says that larger firms tend to become wholly domestic-owned. And then finally, in terms of the value added from marketing effort or the domestic sales share, we see that higher the domestic sales shares in total sales, less likely the firm will be wholly foreign-owned, but more likely that they will be wholly domestic owned. And again, this is consistent with the predictions from our model. So what we do sequentially is essentially add the two-digit industry dummies, and then we will be adding the province dummies. And even after adding these industry dummies, we see that our main conclusions remain unaltered, except for we see that increases in value added from the production effort actually makes it less likely that the firm will become wholly domestic owned, which is something at odds with our current model. And strictly interpreted, what this is saying is that the more effort the production manager is putting into the firm, the less likely they're going to be wholly domestic owned. So one explanation, and again, this is, there are several explanations that came to our mind, might be the idea that these human resource practices in Chinese firms might be different. So the incentives for the production manager might be different in wholly domestic-owned enterprises. But this is something we are not really able to explain within the context of our current model. And finally, what we do is add province dummies. And again, what we note is that the results or our firm-level determinants, again, have a good explanatory power in explaining these transition decisions, except for this variable where the increases in value added from production effort tends to lower the likelihood of becoming wholly domestic owned. So since multinomial logic model coefficients are a little harder to interpret, I also computed the elasticity. So essentially, looking at this third column, which is our preferred specification with the province and industry level controls, what this is telling us is the more technologically advanced the firm, so essentially a 1% increase in this value added to technology effort increases the likelihood of becoming wholly foreign owned by 0.19%, while decreasing the likelihood of becoming wholly domestic owned by 0.35%. And similarly, going down the line, what we see is increases in value added from production effort increases the likelihood of becoming wholly domestic owned by 0.67%, while it reduces the likelihood of becoming wholly domestic owned by 0.93%, and so on as we move down this row. So these effects to us seem to be fairly significant, both economically and statistically speaking. So we think that these firm-level determinants that we have been able to characterize with our model explain these decisions well in terms of what these transitions might be in the post-2000 period. So what we do further is essentially we now allow for variation in these outside options for firms. So the idea is, in terms of technology effort, we posit that firms that have strong or powerful local partners, so typically affiliated with the state government, may have better return to their intellectual property. So the idea again being that having a strong, powerful local partner might block competition by other firms so that your technology is more protected within the confines of the firm, which would make it less likely for the firm to become wholly foreign-owned, for instance. So they'll be more likely to remain as a Sino-foreign joint venture. And in terms of production effort, we hypothesize that in firms which is dense with firms, similar types of firms within its own four-digit industry, managers will have better outside options. So the idea is that if the relationship breaks down, a production manager can go out and find a job easily, which means they're more likely to put in more effort into the joint venture and they'll be more likely to remain a joint venture. And finally, in terms of marketing effort, we experiment with the idea that in industries where the state share is increasing, we think that in these industries, joint ventures will rely more on the Chinese partner to make local sales because the state already has a powerful presence. And so we think if that's the case, this will affect the likelihood of transitioning to wholly domestic owned or wholly foreign owned states. And in fact, they will probably be more likely to remain as a joint venture. So what we do is we try to proxy for these variables and interact them with our main firm level characteristics. So the first variable of interest is this affiliation dummy. So in the data, what we observe are if a firm is affiliated with the central or the provincial government level, and we give those dummies a value of 1, essentially proxying for a powerful state partner. And then in terms of the changes in the state share of industry sales, we look at the change between 98 and 2000 of the state shares of sales within a particular 4-digit Chinese industrial classification code, or their industrial code. And then to proxy for the manager's outside option, we look at the total number of firms in a particular 4-digit industry and city as the joint venture in question, and look at it as a share of the total number of firms in that city, and we normalize it with 100. So what we do is essentially interact these variables. And what we had posited was that if a firm has a powerful state partner, and if it's technologically advanced, it would be less likely to become a Sino-foreign joint venture, which is what we see. And this is, to us, an interesting result, and it makes sense, and something we'll have to push further, as we discussed with Heather. And it also makes, so what this is saying is basically greater the value added from technology effort, the likelihood is greater for firms, joint ventures to become wholly foreign-owned, but less so if they have a powerful state partner. And similarly, it makes it less likely that they will also become wholly domestic owned. And the second interaction that we look at is basically with value added and the manager's outside option. Again, we see that greater the value added, more likely the firm will become wholly foreign owned, but less so in cities where there are better options for these managers to find a job. We don't see it having any explanatory power in terms of transitioning to wholly domestic owned, although in our preferred model we do see some action. And thirdly, we interact the domestic sales shares with the changes in state share of industry sales. Again, our hypothesis was that in these industries it would be more important to have the local Chinese partners, so these firms would be more likely to remain as joint ventures. And in fact, we don't see a lot being explained by this variable, although we see this negative and significant variable, which is saying that if you are in industries with similar firms in your area, you're less likely to become wholly domestic owned. But if we look across these columns, there's not a lot of conclusive evidence.
Do you have the main variables in the table, which is not
here? You mean, do we have the main effects and the interactions? No, we don't include the main effects for the interactive variables. So are you thinking, so you mean in terms of trying to figure out the total effect of the, yeah, we do actually. So we include it in, let me just make sure. Okay, let me make a note of that. Yeah, I actually don't present it here, we did do it. So you're concerned about it because then we'd be able to get at the total effect by looking at the main effect plus the interacted. Is that right? That's
yeah. You have to have the main effect to be able to draw.
Okay. So then, just to summarize, what we have found so far is that basically, in terms of who owns and controls the firm, we find that technologically advanced firms are more likely to become wholly foreign-owned, but less so if they have a powerful state partner. In terms of value added from production effort, we find that higher the value added in production effort, the more likely they are to become wholly foreign-owned, but the opposite is true for wholly domestic-owned, which to us is an interesting result. And finally, we find that joint ventures with relatively large domestic sales shares are more likely to become wholly domestic owned. So, yeah.
Do you have something about exports in there?
So when we control for the domestic sales share, we're essentially controlling for exports because it's normalized by the total sales.
Oh, it's normalized.
Yeah, so it's a share that we include in there. So finally, just thinking about some policy implications that our results suggest is that because we find more productive firms less likely to become domestic owned, this is consistent with the idea that there might be issues with intellectual property protection that still exist in China. And this is probably not surprising, thinking about, even if we read the newspapers about, you know, foreign firms worrying about this issue in China to date. And then we find that high domestic sales shares leads to increased likelihood of a domestic buyout, again suggesting that local connections are still very important today when navigating the business climate in China. And finally, despite significant policy changes, and these might be changes that actually take place or the anticipated changes, we find that there is still a great role for imperfect contracts because we see that majority of our joint ventures choose to remain so in this business climate. So thank you for your time. That's all I have.